Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. My guest is a former National League MVP, batting champion, two-time World Series champion, and a beloved New York Met, both on the field and in the broadcast booth. As we found out this spring, Keith Hernandez is also pretty good on Twitter. His new book is called I'm Keith Hernandez, an account of his early years before the 82 Cards and the 86 Mets. We'll talk about his childhood, the 2018 Mets, and more right now. Keith Hernandez, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be here.
Why did you want to talk about the early part of your life, leading up to the time when, you know, most baseball fans got to know you?
We realized that if we would have done my entire life up to the present, it would have been around an 800-page book. And that's not what Little Brown wanted. They wanted 90,000 words, which is around 320 pages. So we all came together and said, okay, everybody knows the finished product. Me as the polished player that came to New York, but they don't really know my journey to get there. It deals with my childhood, my father. I was a child prodigy. My dad played pro ball. I was a first baseman, taught my brother and I how to play the game, up through minor leagues, which were, you know, no easy road for me. And then the big leagues, it took me around 3 years to get my feet wet. And finally, the book ends end of April 1980, after my MVP and batting title year in 79. I'd always had bad Aprils. I'd had a good year and a bad year and a good year. And, I wanted to put two back-to-back. And after that, I had a great April in 80, and that's when I realized that I belonged on the same field, not only belonged on the same field, but was a peer with the likes of Tom Seaver, Steve Carlton, Willie Stargell, Dave Winfield, all those great players. I was one of them, and that's where the book ends. And it kind of almost, we researched a lot of my Met years and forward to present. So it kind of, maybe if the book does real well, we will have everything ready to have a sequel.
When you did realize that you belonged in the bigs and you were, you know, a peer with people you'd looked up to, was it a sense of relief? What did you feel?
Oh, well, it took a lot of the burden off. I mean, there's a lot of pressure coming to spring. No, well, I hate that word, pressure. You know, pressure to me is a challenge. But when you're young and you're not sure if you belong, you go to spring training, every game is important. You're trying to make the team. You don't know if you're a big leaguer. So when you finally do realize that, you know, then everything kind of falls into place. You're confident. And then, as you know, it was like the weight of the world was off of me after that. And my career was established.
Let's go backwards. What was your childhood like?
My childhood, I grew up in Northern California, in a coastal beach town surrounded by mountains, 17 miles south of San Francisco, in the Lindemar Beach, which was a small township of Pacifica. My dad served in World War II throughout the war in Pearl Harbor in the Navy. Tons of kids, artichoke fields, very agrarian, a creek running through into the ocean from the mountains. It was very much like Huckleberry Finn, but it had so many kids that played. You know, those days, you know, Mom would just give me maybe a dollar and say, in the summer and go play and come home for dinner at 5 o'clock. You know, there was no worries. And you go out there and you meet the kids. It was basketball season. You meet up at the school and play full court basketball all day. So if it was football, you would play two-hand touch. If it was baseball, it was baseball. So I had a very, very good childhood. My brother and I are very close. He's older by 2 years. And we had my father and mother who were great parents, great loving parents. And sports were very much involved in our life. I played all three sports year-round. And Dad taught us basically how to play the game when we were 5 years old. He custom-made Little League bats for us. He sawed them off because to make them that we could handle the bat. We were, they start throwing tennis balls in front of the garage door, and then was our coach throughout Little League, and it was just a terrific childhood.
I think with baseball, it's fair to say there were times when your dad was very demanding of you. Did he realize earlier than you did that you had a shot to really make it?
Well, the funny thing is that when I came home after my MVP season in 79, and if we came to play the Giants the first time in 1980, and I was hitting around 330 in late May, he had the screen projector set up because he always had mom take film of us playing the games and then batting practice so we can study our swings. And he had the projector set up, and it was one of those old-fashioned projectors with the reels, and you had the, you know, like high school in your audio Vizio, you had the screen you pulled up, and he had everything set up, and before we can hardly say, hey, how are you? I hadn't seen him in a while. It was, here, I want to show you this. Curtains were drawn, and he showed this film, and he goes, I want you to watch this. This is when I realized I knew that you had something special. So I'm thinking maybe it's going to be some pictures of me in high school, or it was me, you know, I was 11 years old in Little League. And he goes, look at this swing, as he ran the film. He goes, that's when I knew that you had something special and I wasn't going to let you blow it.
When you did get to the big leagues, what was the adjustment period like?
Very stressful, a lot of anxiety, very emotional. I struggled. I got called up in 74. On August 25th or August 28th, Joe Torre sprained his thumb. The Cardinals wound up losing the division to the Pirates that year, the last game of the season. And I was very much thrust into the lineup for 4 days until Joe came back. And then I did do some spot playing and pinch hitting, and I did well. I hit 290-something with around 30-something at-bats. Next year, they trade Torre in the offseason, and I'm the heir apparent, and I in 75, and I struggle. I get sent down in May. I mean, I was lost. Completely overwhelmed, I think, more emotionally and mentally than physically. I mean, if you're not there emotionally and mentally, then you're not, your physical abilities aren't going to perform. I get sent down, have to deal with that failure. It felt like failure. And went back down to AAA. I got over what I felt was my shame that I didn't make it. And I wound up hitting 330 the rest of the year in AAA, and then get called back up in September, and I get some spot playing again and hit well. And then 76 comes. I get off to another terrible start. I'm benched in late April, early May. They make a trade that brings in a catcher, and they start playing Ted Simmons at first base, and I can see that I can read the tea leaves. I'm not going to be in the lineup. So as it turned out, the Phillies had a great year that year. They ran away with the division. So at the All-Star break, Red Shandies told me, you're going to play every day. The rest of the year, we're out of it. And that turned my career around. I hit 333 the second half of the season with around about 78 games. I drove in almost 50 runs. I go into the offseason. Red Shandies is fired. Vern Rapp comes in, and he brings in a guy named Roger Freed, who was an ex-major leaguer in his early 30s, and that's, you know, he's touting him as the first baseman. So I go into camp. I know I have a job to fight for, and I better get off to a good start. And lo and behold, in 77, I get off to a great start. I have my first good April, and I have really my breakout year. You know, I hit 291, and I hit 15 home runs and drove in 91 runs. The next year, I have a good first half, and then I just completely fall apart in the second half of the season. I hit like 220. This was awful. I can't explain it. It was just terrible. I wound up hitting 255 for the year. Just an awful year. Going to spring training in 79, you know, will the real Keith Hernandez step up? He's had one good year. Da, 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 da. I get off to a terrible April. Ken Boyer's our manager, who had me in AAA, and I'm hitting 230. Towards the end of April, we're flying to Houston. He comes back to the back of the plane, and he says, Keith, I know you're struggling right now. He goes, but you're my first baseman. I've seen you play for 2 years. You are something special. I'm going to sink or swim with you. I'm going to lose my job with you. You are going to be in the lineup every day. Well, I wind up hitting 300 every month, 380 in 2 months. The lowest I hit in a month was 333. I win the batting title, win the MVP, co-MVP with Willie Stargell. And I go into 1980, and this is where the book ends, with still trepidation. I haven't put 2 years back-to-back, and the press in St. Louis is saying, okay, what kind of year are we going to have from him? I still wasn't established, and I felt I wasn't established, even though I had a MVP season and a batting title season and an All-Star season. Well, 1980, I get off to a great start in April, and that's where the book ends. It's May 1st, and I realize I belong in the big leagues. So you kind of get the gist of my fragility, emotional fragility, my ups and downs. I wasn't a cocksure guy. That, you know, very few guys that I played with that came up to the big leagues and they felt that they were great, and they just, and it wasn't a front, you know, it wasn't a facade. Deep inside, they had their demons, they had to fight. So this is what I wanted to project in the book. And if we'd gone any further, it wouldn't have been able to have the detail of my struggle to get to the top.
One thing you didn't mention just now, but I think you alluded to it, which is in the book, is that counter to the rule, there's no crying in baseball. You cop to crying going through some of the struggles.
Well, I think I'm not the only one. My mom used to always say mm-hmm. it's okay for men to cry. Crying, it releases all the emotion. And the thing is, you just don't want to wallow in it. And you just pick yourself up and you dig in your feet a little harder and you fight back harder. And you strive for your goal. My goal was I wanted to be a major league player. I knew that when I was my first year in Little League, when I was 8 years old. It's what I wanted to be. And I just didn't want to be a major leaguer. I wanted to be a star. I think every kid that wants to play sports has that dream. And, you know, it's just not an easy road. It just wasn't a yellow brick road for me. It was a lot of bumps and a lot of emotional times when I was very lonely and really down in the dumps, but you know, you persevere, and it's portrayed in the book.
You're a broadcaster in a very tough baseball town. When a player is, you know, not living up to expectations, or you know, ending up in the back page of the tabloids or what have you, does your experience in your own life, having fits and starts on your way to stardom, influence the way that you deal with players today in terms of you know, in the clubhouse and what you say on TV?
That's a good question. When I first got away from the game and I didn't watch baseball for about five years, my career ended. My body just gave out, and I retired when I was 37. I had back surgery, and at that age, I just said, heck, I'm not going to do the rehab. But that kind of rehab, to play at that kind of level and put that kind of stress on my body as a major league season would do. And I have a whole second half of my life ahead of me, so my career didn't end the way I like it, would have liked it to. I didn't have a Derek Jeter ending. So I was a little bit embittered. I didn't know what to do. My whole life had been baseball. I got a whole, here I am, 37, and I got, you know, hopefully at that point, 50 years left to live, and what am I going to do? So I didn't watch baseball for a long while, and then the McGuire and Sosa home run chase, which wound up being tainted eventually with steroids, unfortunately, brought me back into the game and eventually got me in the booth. And then in the beginning, I was a taskmaster. I knew how to play the game. I pushed my teammates, and I guess pretty much like my father to a degree. Isn't that interesting? And wouldn't accept anything but, you know, excellence in the field and being on point. And, you know, I would get all upset up in the booth. And I read this book called The Gas House Gang, and I read a thing about Frankie Frisch, who was the Fordham Flash, and he was the player manager of the Gas House Gang, the 1934 Cardinals that won the World Series. And he came to the realization when he managed, he said that he was a great player. Everything came easy for me, he said. And I realized that everybody was trying, but not everybody had the same ability. And what was easy for me was difficult for them in a lot of areas and different players. And that made him relax a little more, not be such a hard driver on his players. When I read that, it just completely segued right into my broadcasting in the booth, to back off. As long as the players are doing their best, hustling, you know, physical errors are going to happen. The mental errors are the things that bother me the most. And, you know, a lack of hustle or laziness, those are the things that bother me. But you know what? I'm just not at this stage now. I'm over 15 years in the booth. I'm just not going to get all bent out of shape over it. You know, I just do reporting. I'm past that. So there was a process for me to go through to become the broadcaster I was, and just watch the game, call the game, don't get so emotional about it and get so bent out of shape. And most of the time, the players are trying.
The game is different in some ways from when you were playing. The mound visits are now limited. We've got instant replay moving in. Are there changes you'd like to see, further changes to baseball?
The game is different. It's more home run, and there's a lot of strikeouts. A lot of players, what's happened today is less attention to detail. They're going to make their money hitting home runs. They're not going to make their money being a good defender. But ultimately, it is if you hit 30 home runs and drive in 100 runs, they're going to pay you big money, and the money is exorbitant today. And we've gotten away from the detail of the game. And some of the baseball awards-to-be, I think, became intoxicated by the steroid era, the home run chase with McGuire. The game was on the ropes there, and it brought it back to life. And I think with all the long ball, everybody hitting home runs, and I think steroid still has its ugly shadow over the game, and has an influence where the management today wants the long ball and not the hit and run, not the stolen base. They got guys that don't run that well, but are sluggers. I think the most exciting thing is a double in the gap, and there's a close play at the plate, or the runner scoring from first. I think that is one of the more, and it's a close play. The fans are there. They see the ball coming in. They see the runner running, the slide, the tag. And that, to me, with the smaller ballparks, which they want, makes more home runs. These guys are bigger and stronger today. They're all 6'4", 6'5". They're giants today. It's amazing. I've been out of the game now almost 30 years, and this is a whole new generation, and they're bigger and stronger. I think the game is starting to come back to that, where you bunch more hits. But the pendulum will swing back. I just think it's gone one way, and it's starting to come back a little bit. I've actually enjoyed the games this year. Last year, we played 3-hour-plus games pretty much all year long, and that, to me, is just it shouldn't be. It's just ridiculous. The games are faster now, whatever they've done. But basically the culprits, I feel, are the pitchers. They're 0-2 on hitters, and they don't know how to put them away. And the count invariably goes to 3-2, and that ups the pitch count, which is so important today. And he brings in the relievers. That takes time, and he's 3-2 counts. And then the next thing you know, you got a 3.5-hour game.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the current Mets briefly. As we speak, they're a game over 500, but still very much in the thick of things in the NL East, cooled off a little bit after a pretty explosive start to the year. There's been some drama. You know, there's a bad homestand. Matt Harvey's gone. Where do you think the team sits here as we're talking in, about mid-May?
Well, they got off to the historic start, the best start ever in Met history. And that has been squandered away. And, we haven't been hitting, and this is a veteran lineup. I'm not worried about the offense. I think they'll come around. They've been down this road before. They've been in slumps, and they'll be able to handle it. The pitching is always the name of the game. And, you've got two good pitchers in Syndergaard and DeGrom. And the back three starters haven't done it. Harvey, of course, is gone. And Matt hasn't pitched up to potential, although his last start was good. Wheeler has not pitched up to potential, but his last start in Cincinnati was good. Vargas has had three horrible starts, just getting hit, knocked around big time. And if those three guys don't pick it up, if you look at every starter, if they don't get hurt, has 32 starts. That's only 64 games that DeGrom and Syndergaard can pitch in, and they're not going to win every one of them. There's a little less than 100 games remaining with the other three guys, so they've got to pick it up. If they don't, it's not going to be a very successful year.
How many times a day are you asked about Seinfeld?
I am. It's either a drought or pours. I mean, either I go through a day and no one even knows who I am, or I have a day where it's like a dozen people. Particularly when I'm traveling through airports, walking through airports, someone will come behind me and say, "Let me help you move. Can I help you move?" What was it like to kiss Elaine? Nice game, pretty boy. I get those, which is just hilarious. So, you know, that was a very fortunate for me to have been in that particular sitcom and that particular show, which was both are iconic, and I just was very, very lucky.
Go ahead, kiss her. I'm a baseball player, damn it.
What's he waiting for? I thought he was a cool guy.
Come on, I won the MVP in 79. I can do whatever I want to.
Oh, this is getting awkward.
Well, good night.
Good night. Who does this guy think he is?
I'm Keith Hernandez.
Okay, the last thing I'll ask you is about your new Twitter account. You were on Twitter for a while, you left, and quickly this spring you've become a hugely popular follow and also very funny. In my business, we're always looking to get posts, get more attention, so what's the secret?
I have people that want to know about my life. Obviously, people on Twitter love to talk about their life. And, you know, I brought Haji in. I mean, I didn't know much about it.
That's your cat, just for people who
know. Yeah, Haji, my cat, obviously, has become more famous than me. And when I learned, someone told me, you can do video on Twitter. So I learned how to do video. So I just one morning got up, and I always go get the paper. I put Haji on my shoulder, and I walk out the front door and up the driveway and let him look around. And I pick up the paper, so I decided to video it, and that just went viral. And all of a sudden, I have 70,000 followers, and it keeps moving up every day. I always like to write, and I always have. I always got A's in creative writing. I loved English literature, and I took 2 years of typing in high school, which was probably the two most productive classes I took in high school that I can go forward with, that it's useful in my daily life. I can type. So, I just do it every day in the morning, and it just flows off. I'm able to write as if I'm talking. It just kind of goes from my brain to my fingertips, and we have fun with it. And then people want to see Haji. They want to see more videos of Haji. And it's really, they got people that send me pictures of their cat and say, can we meet? My cat wants to meet your cat. It's just absolutely hilarious.
It's funny how, in the end, it just all goes back to cats on the internet. That seems to be the secret.
Well, there's a lot of animal lovers out there, correct? And they just found it interesting that here I am, this supposed persona of this ex-major league player, and he's got a cat instead of a dog. You know, I can't have a dog because I travel too much. I've had Haji for 15 years. He's my buddy. Vet said he's in great shape, and he's living to his 20s, and I'm going to make sure that he's going to hang around for a long, long time. He's my sidekick.
Well, we've been speaking with the Met great Keith Hernandez. His new memoir of his early years is called I'm Keith Hernandez, and you can catch his broadcasts of the New York Mets on SNY and, of course, on Twitter. Keith, I hope when Volume 2 comes out, we can have a chance to talk again about the 86 Mets and all of that fun. So thank you so much for all this time.
Well, thank you for the time, and I'm glad I had this time here to really go and have this in-depth conversation about the book. Thank you so much.
Again, Keith Hernandez's new memoir is called I'm Keith Hernandez. I'm Ian Pickus, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.